KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Way, way back, my mother gave me one of those thick Reader's Digest books on home repair. And it was the best thing. I could refer to that and fix anything.
When we have a sense that time, a real sense that time is running out, things take on a particular kind of glow and significance.
I'm not worried about this blocking the project, but I am worried about it being one more thing that delays and impedes and just frankly makes everybody's life harder than it has to be.
We wade again into the arena controversy today on the program. That was a pro arena backer. Well, he may not be worried about it, but the longshoremen say they're going to sue over the arena review process. We'll see why they're doing that and what that's going to do for the overall effort to get another NBA basketball team in Seattle. We also heard from Dean Young. He's a poet. And Roger Ferris is going to be here to talk home repair and take some of your calls. We'll take a little time to take your calls with Roger Ferris. It's fall, and you may have some questions about getting your house battened down for the rains, which are a-coming. On Weekday on KUOW, I'm Steve Scherer. Thanks for being here. We start with Dean Young. He had just been handed his new book of poems from the editors at Copper Canyon Press when we sat down to talk last week. Bender, New and Selected Poems by Dean Young. He said it was exciting, daunting, and flabbergasting to hold such a heavy book in his hand. It was a pretty thick book. It's a grown-up size book, he said. The book of his lifetime. A lifetime that was threatened by a weak heart. Dean Young had to have a heart transplant. He still avoids shaking hands. Doctors still worrying over the strain. It's a recent operation. Dean Young has published more than a dozen books, including Elegy on Toy Piano, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2005. His poems have been included in the Best American Poetry Series 7 times. He teaches poetry. He sometimes gives his students the assignment of writing a bad poem so they'll recognize the failing the next time they write any poem. He's also an NEA fellow. But imagine being a poet who writes about heart and emotion and passion, and then having to deal with the weakness of that very organ. It's one of the things we talked about. He did also say that one of the great things about writing poetry in general was that it really doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter if I write a poem or not. It matters to me. And my challenge is to make that matter into matter, to make that matter matter to some extent.
How long have you been writing? Your whole life?
My whole life. As long as I've been able to write, I've been writing poems. You'd think I'd be a lot better at it by now, but I think that just about everybody writes poems at some point in their life. And the question to me is not why do I write poems, is why did everybody else stop? Like, why did you stop writing poems?
I never did.
Never?
I never stopped.
Ah, good.
But they just sit in a drawer, but they please me. And so I guess that's enough.
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe the question is why did I take that next maybe drastic step of trying to become a poet or trying to get my poems read and published?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's a complicated question about ego, I suppose, and matters of ego I don't particularly like exploring.
Not even in your poems? Not even when you're pushing the envelope?
Well, I hope I explore everything in my poems and that it's all material. Eliot said that, you know, everything is material.
Dean Young has published over a dozen books, including Elegy on Toy Piano, which was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2005 for poetry, and a new collection, New and Selected Poems, the grown-up volume, Bender. Which, were you on one when you wrote that?
Well, I like to think that my whole life's been a bender.
All right, so one of the reasons people are thinking about your poetry, besides you getting the 2005 Pulitzer nomination, you write a lot about the heart, and you think a lot about your heart and other people's hearts.
Yeah.
You had a heart transplant.
Yeah, figuratively and literally, and it has become a subject that has had its revenge on me, I suppose, in actuality.
Because you wrote about heart before you had heart problems?
Well, I've known that I've had a that I had a subpar heart for quite some time, and my father died young of heart problems. So it's always been an awareness for me. And of course, failure of heart in all its metaphoric considerations and possibilities, I think, is one of the general subjects of poetry.
I think you told NPR, I think that one of the jobs of poets is to think about death. They stare at their own death, and through it, they still see the world.
Mortality, when we have a sense that time, a real sense that time is running out, things take on a particular kind of glow and significance and importance. If you only have 5 seconds on left on this plane and what you're looking at is a thumbtack, that thumbtack is going to have amazing resonance. So I think poetry is very involved as an art form in time running out. It's defined by time running out. The nature of the line is that it ends. The nature of the stanza is that it ends. The nature of a poem. Poems are brief. So that we're aware of this mortality, the mortality of our perceptions and the mortality of our emotions. And that's one of the things that poetry is both about as a subject, but it also demonstrates as an art form.
I like that. Poetry is brief. Life is brief. So I guess even as a young man, even as a young boy, writing poetry, mortality was sitting on your shoulder?
Yeah, and I think even as a kid I was weirdly sort of... death is such a mystery, and it still remains an enormous mystery. My dog, Lori, my wife's dog, who she had for 10 years, who became our dog, died a couple weeks ago now. And we were there with her, and we watched her, and she let us know that it was time, and she was there, and then she wasn't there. And it's very, very strange.
Yeah, the space, the traces. You can see where the idea of ghosts came from.
Oh, absolutely.
Your mortality.
Yeah, the funny thing is that, you know, a lot of my friends are hard-bitten intellectual atheists. And one of the things that they've responded to, you know, very helpfully to us is that with the death of Chloe, our dog, so many people have said to us, you know, don't worry, she's still with you. She's still waiting. She'll be waiting for you on the other side. And I've sort of come to the conclusion that a lot of intellectuals don't believe humans have souls, but they believe dogs do.
Oh, it's just their way of wanting to believe when they tell themselves they don't. Will you share a poem with us?
Sure. This is called Frittage. How goofy and horrible is life. Just look into the faces of the lovers as they near their drastic destinations, the horses lathered and fagged. Just look at them handling the vase priced beyond the rational beneath the sign stating the store's breakage policy. And what is the rational but a thing we must always break? I am not the only one composed of fractious murmurs. From the point of view of the clouds, it is all inevitable and dispersed. They vanish over the lands to reconstitute over the seas, themselves again, but no longer themselves. What they wanted, they no longer want. Daylight fidgets across the frothy waves. Most days, you can't even rub a piece of charcoal across paper laid on some rough wood, without a line appearing, a fish's umbrella skeleton. Once we believed it told us something of ourselves. Once we believed in the diagnostic powers of ants. Upon the eyelids of the touched and suffering, they'd exchanged their secretive packets, like notes folded smaller than chemicals, the dancers pass while dancing with another, a quadrille. They told us nearly nothing, which may have been enough, now that we know so much more. From the point of view of the ant, the entire planet is a dream quivering beneath an eyelid, And who's to say the planet isn't? From the point of view of the sufferer, it seems everything will be taken from us except the sensation of being crawled over. I believe everything will be taken from us, then given back when it's no longer what we want. We are clouds, and terrible things happen inside clouds. The wolf's mouth is full of strawberries. The morning's a phantom hum of glories.
Ouch, Dean Young. You were not in a particularly cheery mood that morning.
Oh, huh.
Were you?
Well, I don't know. I think the poem is full of hope. Well, maybe not hope, but at least it's vivid.
It is. It was truly vivid. Things will be taken from us and then returned when we... What was that line? When we don't need them as much?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
When I write a poem, and I think this is probably true of a lot of people, that it's... For me, it's not necessarily trying to find what I believe and writing that down. It's finding what the language is willing to say, and that if it says that, if that language says that with enough rhetorical, poetic power, it gets authority. So it's when I write, I don't have intention. What I'm trying to do is attend, and I'm trying to attend to what the language is telling me as I write. I always tell my students to, you know, don't worry about how bright you are or anything when you write a poem, because you're collaborating with a genius at all times, and the genius is the language. And if you can tap into that, you'll write some amazing things.
Tell me that is an amazing thought. The genius is the language. That's a great way to think about reading and writing in your work. I didn't mean to label his poem as negative. Of course it's not. It was a rich and diverse poem. I just was struck by some of his vivid images and how they felt, which, of course, is the power of a great poet, yes? Dean Young has published more than a dozen books, including Elegy on Toy Piano, which was a 2005 finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. He teaches poetry at the University of Texas at Austin, where, as we said, he sometimes tells his students to write bad poetry, and then they can figure out what a good poem is from that. He has a new collection from Copper Canyon Press. It's called Bender, New and Selected Poems. This is Weekday.
KUOW 94.9. Weekday's home repair expert Roger Ferris takes calls and answers your questions. That's coming up next.
KUOW and Seattle Arts and Lectures present Hari Kunzru, British essayist, journalist, and author of four novels, including Gods Without Men, at Benaroya Hall on Tuesday, October 23rd. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the Evergreen State College, a four-year public college in Olympia, where students are challenged to unlock their passion for learning in small, theme-based classes. Information available from representatives at fall college fairs and online at evergreen.edu/welcome.
56 degrees in Seattle. Look for a high today near 61 with rain. Tonight's low around 51 degrees. Showers, possibly a thunderstorm, and winds 15 to 18 miles an hour, gusting as high as 25 miles an hour. On Tuesday, the high near 57 degrees with showers. Tuesday night's low around 43, mostly cloudy with a 50-50 chance of showers.
Roger Ferris is coming up in a few moments on Weekday on KUOW. I'm Steve Scherr. Novelist Christopher Buckley skewers Washington, D.C. in his book, They Eat Puppies, Don't They? And we thought, given that we are in the midst of a campaign season, it might be a reminder, might be a good time to remind ourselves about the comedy and the laughter that can come from skewering Washington, D.C. He looks at a Washington lobbyist and a neocon policy wonk team when they start up a rumor that China is plotting to assassinate the Dalai Lama, and then it spins out of control. Christopher Buckley is no stranger to politics, of course. His father, William F. Buckley, founded the National Review. He had a back page column in the Review until 2008, when he was forced to leave over a blog post he wrote in the Daily Beast. We spoke to Buckley in June, and I asked him about that article and why he had to resign.
I wrote a blog, which I thought was a perfectly okay reasoned blog, saying I was going to vote for Barack Obama. And a part, it was about 60% pro-Obama and 40% my terrible misgivings over Sarah Palin. And I also had a column in the National Review, and I was asked to resign from that. I don't know quite how that came about, since I was on the board of National Review at the time.
Are you still, by the way?
No.
Really?
No.
Does that rankle at all?
No. But I quoted at the time, and it became a silly controversy. Who cares what I?
Yeah,
what my
it was fun.
Politics are. But I quoted Ronald Reagan, who was, you know, famously a quite a liberal Democrat, had been started out, and he famously said, "I didn't leave the Democratic Party; the Democratic Party left me."
So, how about now?
Now, I mean,
where are you standing in the world of politics?
Who cares?
Politics. What was he said? The only reason anybody cares is because my last name was Buckley.
Which is true. I'm not a pundit. I'm not an ideologue. I'm a hack novelist. If you want my political views, you'll have to pay $26.95. Very reasonably priced, I should say.
What's the name of the first weapon these guys were trying to sell that the Congress, for some reason, decided not to fund?
It starts out with a Senate hearing about funding for a drone airplane. I would like to point out, I started writing this book 3 years ago.
Did you, before drones were so popular?
Well, drones existed, obviously, but drones are very hot now. And anyway, they're trying to, this defense company called Groping Sprunt is trying to get funding for a jumbo drone. You know, the size of a 747 that, you know, may or may not carry
well-armed
weapons. But they want to give it a nice sort of cuddly name, so they call it Dumbo.
Yeah.
Dumbo.
And after that sort of tanks, the plot hinging around Bird McIntyre and he enlisting this neocon, sexy neocon,
OreoCon, please.
OreoCon, I'm sorry. OreoCon. To, I guess, even a bigger weapon, right?
And
more
yes.
And more fear involved.
Well, Bird is a defense lobbyist. He works for a company called, as I say, Groping Sprunt, which seemed like a good name for an aerospace giant. And they've come up with a really cool, scary weapons program that is specifically targeted at China. But it's very, very top secret. But the trouble is, we have this interdependent relationship with China. You can't, you know, China is the de facto Bank of America, and you can't just go around announcing, oh, you know, we've got a really cool weapon aimed right at you. So the Congress is a little bit skittish. In the book, I would say I would add the Congress is concerned about spending. So right away, you know, it's fiction, right? And Byrd is tasked by his bosses at Groping Sprunt with fomenting anti-Chinese sentiment in order to facilitate the appropriations.
But he's pushed. His ties are officially severed.
Yeah. He can't be seen. He can't be, you know, directly connected. So they go through this sort of fake, he's sort of, He ostensibly leaves, but they're still paying him through a series of cutaways. So he starts a Potemkin organization, I think, called Pan Pacific Solutions. You know, that consists of a mailbox somewhere in Northern Virginia.
All to get people to be afraid of China. There are people trying to be afraid of China. And the Obama administration is even beefing up its military efforts.
Interesting things are going on. We have, I think, by the way, I would say whatever, I mean, for whatever it's worth, I think Obama has been a very good commander-in-chief.
They're not letting you back in.
I'm sorry?
They're not letting you back in.
I'm trying very hard to get an ambassadorial appointment out of this, and my phone is not ringing off the hook from the White House. But anyway, yes, we're redeploying a good portion of the United States Navy to the South China Sea. We've stationed 1,000 Marines in Darwin. China is flexing its muscles. It's increasing its naval power. I don't think China has imperialistic or my reading of it, anyway, and I think Henry Kissinger is also Henry Kissinger's reading, and he knows a thing or two about China. It's not that it has imperialistic designs, but it does have designs, and therefore we're seeing a naval buildup. At the same time, let me point out the defense budget of the United States is over $700 billion a year. The defense budget of China. $70 billion. This fact I learned from Gordon Krovitz's column in the Wall Street Journal earlier this week. China spends more on its firewall and internal police than it does on defense.
Dr. Kissinger, by the way, plays a role in this book.
Yes, he does. He's off stage, but he does play a role.
Everybody wants to get his opinion.
Well, it's an opinion worth having. I read one of his books in the course of researching this. The title of Henry's book about China is On China. If you're Henry Kissinger, you can just call it On China. I have to dance like a French poodle on two hind legs. And they eat puppies, don't they? But it's a I'm here to promote my book, not Henry's. However, I have to say, if anyone who really wants to understand the Chinese mind would do well to read On China.
Well, that was Christopher Buckley about his book, They Eat Puppies, Don't They? We just thought it'd be nice to touch a little bit of skewering Washington, D.C.'s way. We had him on the show in June, and you can hear the full interview by going to our website, kuow.org. Roger Ferris is here. Roger Ferris, home repair guru, FEMA worker, and apparent poet fancier.
Yeah, right.
Tell me about your theory of writing poetry.
Well, as I explained, my poetry becomes far, far better if I use the free computer translation to switch it over to Italian and then use a free computer translation to retranslate it back into English, because it comes out with better words and in a more interesting order.
Oh, I just like the idea that you're using a translation to enhance your poetry. That's a good idea. I'm going to try that.
It's all about enhancement.
Roger Ferris is Weekday's home repair expert. He's director emeritus of the Finney Neighborhood Center Well Home Program. He's also the Hazard Mitigation Community Education Outreach Supervisor for FEMA. Wait, I thought we had a new title for you.
Well, that CEO part, CEO group supervisor, is wonderful, and I do love that. And I did actually get rehired as that. We all 7,000 of us or whatever, the reservists, had to reapply for our jobs and make the cut. And it was very complicated. I think a lot of people who didn't want to deal with all the forms and interviews and whatnot, and proof.
Do they do that because they want a leaner government because the contract issue?
I am not privy to all the reasons for doing it. And a lot of people were very skeptical. But I think there probably were some very good reasons. That's what I found out about big bureaucracies, is when they do something, it may not be entirely evident what it's all about. But if you just give it some time, you start to find out more about why that was a good idea.
All right.
So that's I'm working under that theory, that it was all a good idea. And I'm happy because I got rehired.
All right. Are there some classes that are coming up here?
The earthquake retrofit classes, of course, are ongoing. Next week, Saturday, I believe, it's Beacon Hill Library. And in December, I think on the 1st of December, West Seattle Branch Library, for the free earthquake retrofit class, how to do it, or how to monitor your contractor so that they do it correctly and make sure that all the things were done up to the proper standard. And to sign up for those, because we do like to have a good idea about how many people are coming, you call Seattle Emergency Management at 206-233-5076.
And outside Seattle, you can either come in, or other municipalities also have these similar classes.
The whole regional retrofit program is still expanding. So Victoria, BC, has expressed an interest in finding out all about this. Bellingham is cranking up. Portland and Tacoma has been active, but all the east side communities. And so local building officials know what this is all about, and they have the plan sets in many, many places around the Northwest.
Great. Our number is 206-543-5869 if you have a question for Roger, or 1-800-289-5869.
Well, also I should mention at the Finney Neighborhood Center, there are ongoing classes on that topic, earthquake retrofit, but other things like how to build a dormer on your second story addition. And so coming up pretty soon, I think it's in a week or two, at the Finney Center, a wonderful architect who knows a lot about that because he's designed so many of them. We'll give the little two-hour class on how to think about adding additional space on top of your house.
Will they have classes or information about questions like this? Sergey writes, I have a 4-foot retaining wall that needs drainage holes put in. Thinking about renting a concrete drill and doing it myself. Any advice?
Well, those drainage holes will plug up very quickly with dirt unless you excavate on the backside of the concrete wall and put in gravel and filter fabric to keep the dirt out of the hole. So that's the problem. Drainage holes are a really good idea, but they will very likely become plugged unless you take that additional step, which is, of course, very difficult additional step, excavating out all that stuff on the backside. But
you couldn't do it from the outside and somehow shove some kind of filtering system?
I think you need a fairly significant kind of filtering system to keep them from getting plugged.
All right.
And so that's the bad news. It's a great idea, though. And, you know, you could drill holes and hope that it drains, and it might, depending on what kind of, if it was very sandy back there, maybe it would still work. It'd be a matter of luck.
So just do the work. You'll have to do the work, Sergey. All right, from the Facebook page, Tiffany Royal High. Really? Tiffany Royal High? I have an IKEA track lighting fixture in my kitchen. I'm slowly switching light bulbs from halogen to the expensive LEDs. I just purchased my first LED and installed it, but notice it makes a buzzing noise when it's on. Research I've done shows it may have something to do with the fact that it's connected to a dimmer switch. Thoughts? Uh-huh.
Well, some lights are designed to be dimmable and connected to dimmer switches, and others are not. And so you do have to be very careful to read the packaging and so forth and make sure that it says that it can be connected to a dimmer switch. And if not, don't do it. The buzzing could be that, could be something else, and I'm afraid I don't know anything about that except that I'm very sorry.
We have buzzing in our studio right now. Can you hear it?
No.
Yeah. I guess buzzing is just part of the reality. All right, our number is 206-543-5869, 1-800-289-5869.
One thing about the buzzing, though, before we move on. It's possible that there's a poor connection, and that's causing the buzzing. And that would be something to definitely fiddle with, check, and try to eliminate, because a poor connection could lead to heat and, you know, meltdown or fire, that sort of thing.
Things we don't want.
Right. So look out when you have a buzz in an electrical system. Don't just live with it. Try to figure out what it is and stop it.
Oh, all right. That's good. All right. Mike is on Whidbey Island. Hi, Mike.
Good morning. Hey, two questions, Roger. Real quickly, I put the zinc strip on the roof, cleaned all the moss off. The part that faces, the pitch that faces north, it just works like a charm. The pitch of the roof, that is what faces east, the moss still grows, even though I have a zinc strip. Any thoughts?
Well, would it be difficult to rotate your house 90 degrees?
Well, not this time.
Well, my suggestion would be consider additional zinc strips because, you know, they're only sort of marginally effective in shady areas where there are a lot of trees and so forth. And, you know, people have other little tricks for discouraging moss on the roof. Some of the tricks are a little bit dangerous, like sprinkling crystal detergent, you know, dishwasher or clothes washing powder on the roof, that sort of thing. That kills the moss, but it makes your roof very slippery. So I hesitate to say it, but you know, there are little techniques that people use. And you know, you've just run into the universal Northwest problem of you do all these things to discourage moss on the roof, and it comes back anyway.
Okay. Second question. our house is 8 years old, and it has the forced air circulation, we get that little battleship gray dust throughout the house. We've sealed everything that we could seal, but we still get the dust and we have can lights. So my question is there something that you can put over a canned light so that you can control the air being sucked from the attic through the canned light, bringing in the forced air dust, you know, the attic insulation dust?
So that's where that gray stuff is coming from, is your dusty attic. You know, I remember there was a time when people were losing a lot of heat through their ceiling fixtures, their can lights. And so then the manufacturers started kind of upgrading those so that they could be covered with insulation without any risk of problems with fire. And that wouldn't really solve the problem of a little bit of dust getting through, but it was kind of an upgrade. Before people did that, though, the solution for some people was to kind of build a box in the attic over the can light, and then they could insulate over that. And that was kind of a clever solution. Your attic may be very difficult to move around in, but I suppose there could be something like that that's available at building material supply places that could just be popped in on top, and then the insulation, you know, would be kept separate. But it sounds like you know, you may have a little bit of imbalance in your cold air return system. If you don't have enough openings for the cold air to go back into the furnace, then it does tend to create a little bit more negative pressure in the room, and that can suck air from outside or from the attic or whatever. So the only reason I know about that is one time a technician came and looked at my furnace system and said, oh, you know, my gauge here tells me you need another hole right here to let some more cold air return into this unit. It's out of balance.
Did it improve it?
I guess so. I mean, his gauge probably said now it's just right. But you know, that's a possibility. I don't know that that's correct in your case, but you might look into it.
All right. Good luck on that. Here's an email from Nick, by the way, following up sort of on that notion of the Northwest. If I just caulk something with water-based caulk, it got wet and is still sloppy 3 days later. Will it be okay if I can get it to dry out?
Well, that's interesting. So it got wet. Someone took a shower before it was completely
I guess so.
Sealed up.
Yeah,
I kind of think that eventually it'll dry out and that caulk will harden. But then I don't think I've ever made that mistake before. I think I've always kind of warned everyone, don't use this shower until this caulk is thoroughly dry. So I'm not absolutely certain. The good news about caulk is you can rip it out and redo it.
See, I think I did make that mistake once.
What happened?
I had to rip it out and redo it.
Oh, you did?
It never quite dried.
It never really hardened.
I think so. Though I should really say that.
Well,
probably my wife would have a better handle on it.
You would think that a water-based product would eventually dry out and harden.
Yeah.
So I would give it more time and then tear it out and start again.
All right. Alan's in Olympia. Alan, a little experiments with the buzzing, since that's what we were talking about?
Yeah, I got some LED lights at the Puget Rock the Bulb thing, and they're the A-Lamp tulip-type bulbs. We have a fixture that's dimmed. Put them in there. It was noticeable only because our house is so quiet now. I thought, oh, that's interesting, because they are rated to be dimmed from 10% to 100%. I took all of the bulbs out and put them in a fixed fixture, you know, just a lamp, no dimmable, no buzz. So the lady who called, I think what she's going to want to do is determine how important it is if she wants to have that dimmable feature versus the slight noise. For us, it's over our dining table. It's pretty significant. It's not a light we leave on. We're happy to put these LEDs in other applications where we don't get the buzz.
That's a great answer. Well, it's sure, you know, I love it when these calls come in while the original caller might still be listening. So we get an actual useful answer. So thank you very much.
Yeah, Alan, thanks a lot on that. I appreciate
it. When I get a chance to listen.
Great. Thanks. You know, and here's just speaking of canned lighting, Jim writes, we had canned lights installed in our basement. We never use bulbs more than the recommended wattage. yet they burn out very quickly. I'm constantly replacing bulbs. A few bulbs have even exploded. Once I tried a fluorescent bulb in one of the cans, it made a loud buzzing noise and got very hot. Any thoughts as to what's going on?
Well, occasionally I've come across a situation like that, and the problem was that the bulbs were not being screwed in tight enough, and so they were making a poor connection that was buzzing and arcing, and that would cause the exploding light bulb phenomenon. But that's sort of rare that someone just doesn't physically tighten it enough. There are people, though, who are very tentative about light bulbs. They just don't make a good contact. In this case, it sounds like there could be something somewhat defective about the cans themselves, that they're too, maybe they were...
Would it be a wiring issue?
I doubt that.
Not that.
I think it's probably something to do with incompatibility between bulbs and the can, and they just are creating too much heat. You know, they're capturing the heat a little too well and not letting it out or not radiating it away. You know, some of these cans have a little lens on them, and that just traps all the heat. I would go to a lighting store and describe it. Maybe if you can, take a sample of the bulbs and a can if you have one, or find one just like it, and ask them what they do about this kind of thing. And they may have, you know, a really good answer at a sort of lighting specialty store where they've seen it all.
All right. Interesting. All right. Maya's in North Seattle. Hi, Maya.
Hello.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So I was talking to my neighbor the other day who had some insulation pumped into her walls, her exterior walls, which is what we're about to do, too. And she was like, oh, do you have knob and tube wiring? And I said, I don't think so. And she said, well, I do. And I'm really scared that I shouldn't have had the insulation put in.
Well,
what advice you have.
Yeah, I do have advice for that. Technically, knob and tube wiring was designed to be suspended between the knobs, knob to knob, and then where it goes through framing, it goes in a little ceramic tube just to protect it. And so it was designed to be kind of open to the air, let air circulate around it so that it wouldn't overheat. And because a lot of people have buried it under insulation now in their attics or sometimes in their walls, what the electrical building officials, the electrical inspectors say is, if you have knob and tube, just don't overload it. And what that means is, don't ask it to handle more than about 800 watts, which is about half of the normal maximum load for a 15-amp circuit. So you can plug in lamps and clock radios and things like that in maybe a few overhead lighting fixtures, but don't ever ask it to handle a space heater that would be, 1,650 watts, more than twice what knob and tube wiring should be asked to handle. If you do plug in one, it won't trip the fuse or the circuit breaker, but the wire does get significantly warm, and that can lead to the insulation breaking down even more than it already has. You know, the insulation on that type of wiring is old-fashioned, kind of rubber with a little bit of a coating of fabric, and it's not what they would use today. You know, the modern materials are more heat-resistant. The knob and tube wiring also is typically, 14-gauge, so it's thinner. So that's another reason for never having it fused at 20 amps. 15 is the maximum fusing for that, or circuit breaker protection. But, just figuring out what's on that circuit and keeping it down to something less than 800 watts, and you should be fine.
What else were you going to ask, Maya?
Oh, dishwashers. If she's using a dishwasher or washer-dryer...
Right. Anything with a motor is too much for it. So you should put in a new circuit with modern wire to handle a washer dryer or clothes washer. I mean, washer dryer would normally be 220 amp if it's a full size unit. If it's a dryer, that is electric dryer. But yeah, if you have anything with a motor or any major appliance, you don't want to run that off a knob and tube circuit. You should just, get someone to add a brand new circuit with its own wiring.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And speaking of insulation, Carlos writes, I'm a new homeowner. One of the first projects on the list is to add insulation to the attic. I poked my head up there for the first time, and there's debris from a recent roofing job all over the place. We have loose fill insulation. I thought I'd clean up the big stuff, pick out as much as I can. Is there any harm in blowing in new loose fill over the top of insulation that's mixed with shards of wood and roofing nails?
You know, I think it's reasonable to go around, if you can do it safely without falling through the ceiling, and pick up the bigger pieces and put them in a bag and dispose of them, and to leave the little bits and the nails and whatnot. It's just not very practical to try to get all that stuff. And so I think that's the typical answer, and it's appropriate. Just do what you can without risking your life or falling through the ceiling. It's tricky, you know. You have to, as you're moving around up there, you have to figure out where are those ceiling joists, and so your knees and your feet have to stay on them. If you misjudge, your hand or your foot can go right through the ceiling. That's not something you want to experience.
No,
it happens to people. But I would definitely just remove the big stuff and call it good.
All right. Steve's in Redmond. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
I have two issues that I'd like to discuss, and I think they're related, or at least I'm thinking my thoughts on it, the solutions would be related. I've got a house built in 69, and part of the house has a very steep roof, and part, I think, initially was a flat roof, and I think they modified that somewhere down the line and kind of built a slope over a flat roof so the water will slope off. And but they didn't ventilate it properly. I mean, so what has happened, although we don't have any leaks, it's actually under the torch down, it's kind of, you can tell it's rotted, and we're going to have to tear that off and redo it. But I was wondering if you could refer me to a source that would indicate, you know, how should, when you have a kind of a false roof over a previous flat roof, I mean, how should that be ventilated? And I also want to mention that section of the house is over the bedroom where you're breathing a lot in two bathrooms.
Right. This is a very common problem, and the bathrooms have probably contributed a lot of moisture, getting into that space, and then it encountered a surface, the roof deck, that was below the dew point. Condensation occurred, and that eventually leads to rot because you've got high moisture content in the wood. So you're right on target. Now, it is a little bit tricky to put vents through a torch down roof system because it's a low slope roof. That's why they use the torch down membrane rather than, you know, a three tab or something like that. So it was a very good idea for someone to put in a new roof system over the old flat roof, because I'm sure that was a terrible leaker. But ideally that whole attic cavity would have been connected to the other attic spaces and well ventilated in some fashion. When you redo the roof, if you're having to tear down, remove the rotted deck section and so forth, you should be able to put in adequate ventilation at that time. And, another thing that is also a very good idea, if it's physically possible, is to get into that attic space and try to seal any little passages that allow warm, moist air to migrate up from the bathroom area into that attic space. So that's the other side of the equation, is try to keep moisture out of there so that there is less need for ventilation.
All right, sir. Quick but expressive.
Uh-huh.
Your knowledge. I don't mean your knowledge isn't quick but expressive.
Oh, okay.
That segment was quick but expressive of your knowledge.
Very good. Well, thanks. I love doing this. This is just so fun to talk to these good people.
Perhaps do it again, and perhaps next time in Italian verse form.
I'll translate it.
Roger Veris is Weekday's home repair expert, Director Emeritus of the Finney Neighborhood Center Well Home Program, and he works with FEMA on education outreach. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for your phone calls and your emails. Roger will be back. This is Weekday.
Support for KUOW comes from TIAA CREF, helping people pursue their financial goals. Learn more at tiaacref.org/WA.
Former Real Networks executive Alex Albin says digital technology is leading to more connection and more alienation. Ross Reynolds talks with him this afternoon at 12:20.
Support for KUOW comes from the structural engineering firm of Swenson Say Fage, with offices in Seattle and Tacoma, working collaboratively with architects, contractors, and homeowners, as well as public and private sector clients, to create effective building solutions. More information at SwensonSayFage.com.
Thanks to everyone who helped make our fall membership drive a big success. If you didn't get a chance to donate during the drive, you can still make your pledge at KUOW.org. 57 degrees in Seattle, approaching a high near 61 this afternoon with rain. Tonight's low around 51, showers, maybe a thunderstorm, winds 15 to 18 miles an hour, gusting as high as 25 miles an hour.
The King County Council is expected to vote to approve the Memorandum of Understanding with arena backer Chris Hansen later today. But the union representing Seattle longshoremen and warehouse workers says it will file a lawsuit to block a third sports arena in SoDo. The ILWU board member Max Vekic says a new arena built in the middle of a busy freight corridor used by the Port of Seattle will, quote, erode our city's maritime, industrial, manufacturing, and warehousing future. David Mann is an attorney representing the union. David Mann, thanks for talking to us.
Good morning.
What is the basis of your complaint with this lawsuit?
The basis of the complaint is the MOU at this point goes far too far down the path for both the city and the county without undergoing the environmental review they needed to do. Basically, as soon as Mr. Hansen came to the city with a proposal for a publicly owned facility, and again, this is going to be something owned by the public, the city and county at that point needed to stop, start the environmental review process before they let this thing go too far down the path.
But aren't they now saying that with the memorandum of understanding, they will do a full environmental review?
Yes, but look at the rest of the MOU. What are the other 75 pages for after paragraph 5? They've added this language because they knew we were out here making these comments, but it's not stopping the inertia from starting. The rest of that agreement is all about the details. I mean, they're going to start designing a building within a year, start looking at the details long before they've done the review. So it creates basically a sham process. We're going to get a thick book, a thick EIS, but the decision's done. And that's the type of inertia or initial momentum that our courts have said doesn't work in the CEPA.
Now, City Attorney Pete Holmes was quoted in the paper on Friday. He said the agreement with Hansen doesn't violate rules spelled out under the State Environmental Policy Act. He says there will be a full CEPA review, including consideration of one or more alternative sites. Not enough?
No, that's not enough. Again, the same point. The momentum that this has created, are they going to turn around a year from now after they've gone through the environmental review process and tell Mr. Hansen no? Of course not. It started the inertia. They shouldn't be signing into the MOU at this point. And again, let's go back to what is the rest of this MOU for? If they're really going to legitimately study alternatives and take an open-minded view, the city and county should have the information in front of them before they make these commitments. And it's too late once you've entered this MOU.
What's the goal of this lawsuit then? What do you want it to accomplish?
Well, we want the MOU invalidated. They want their city and county should not be committing to or conditionally committing to moving forward with the project at one specific location until first they've done review. So we are looking to invalidate the MOU. We'll ask the court to move as quickly as possible to reach that decision.
Does that happen in other instances? Does a project get a complete environmental review with all the sites or at least a number of sites under consideration?
It does when it's a public project. And again, the distinction is if you come forward with a private proposal to build a building in the city that has to go through the review, you get to look at one site. But if it's going to be a publicly owned facility, the law requires you look at alternative locations in advance.
So if that's the case, give me an example from the past. Like when we had the reviews over the tunnel, did every alternative get a full environmental review? I thought that that's exactly what did not happen.
Well, they did look at some alternative sites, but there's a question on the timing of that one and the details. But again, they did ultimately do an environmental review. I think another alternative we could look at is several years ago, the military was looking to sell off a portion of Discovery Park, and they were basically going to give that land to the city of Seattle for low and mixed income housing. And again, here's the same type situation where the city launched into, decided to go forward with the purchase of that and transfer without going through the environmental review first. And the court stopped them in that case. Both the Superior Court and the Court of Appeals said, no, you can't, the city cannot be committing to any actions until first it does its environmental review.
We're talking with David Mann. He's an attorney representing the ILWU Local 19, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. They are filing a lawsuit to block the third sports arena in SoDo until a full environmental review is done. So would you like to see who pays for that, by the way, and how would you like to see that work?
Well, Mr. Hansen can pay for it. The city could pay for it. But again, nothing would have been wrong with entering an MOU like the first five paragraphs of this one, which is all within the first two pages, which was, look, we're looking at bringing an NBA team to the city, which my clients fully support. But at the same time, before we do anything, we're going to look at alternative sites. And if Mr. Hansen wants to pay for that, which is typical when a private proposal comes through, they pay for the review, and that's it. And that's the agreement should have stopped at that point. And again, the distinction I want to point out is this is going to be a publicly owned building. And before we have a publicly owned facility, we need to look at the right location for it.
Now, let's say this goes through. Is this? How should I look at this? Is this really just an effort to come up with another tactic by which you hope to stop the SoDo Arena from being built?
No, it's a tactic to make sure that the city and county understand fully what they're doing before they make the decision. The city council needs to understand the relative impacts of Mr. Hansen's proposed SoDo location, of a location, let's say, at the Seattle Center, or another allocation, and they need to understand and face what the impacts are and what the differences are before they make a decision. If they ultimately decide at the end of the day that they're going to approve the SoDo site, even though it has significantly more impacts, they can do that. But they're going to have to make that a public vote, and after the public and they are fully informed of the decision they're making. They have to face that information and understand it fairly before they decide.
You know, you've been looking at this as the attorney for the ILWU, so I don't know if it's fair to ask you this, but if this gets either rejected, your lawsuit, or if the MOU is expanded or the review is expanded in some way to meet your satisfaction, and it still comes about that, okay, we like this, this is a good place for it, would the ILWU at that point say, all right, they did the due diligence, we're going to back it?
Well, we're going to make sure first that I mean, I can't speak for whether they will ultimately back it if it comes back to this location. I think we believe if the facts are laid out and the traffic impacts are fully discussed and the parking impacts are fully identified, that this will not be the preferred location. The key right now and what I'm looking at is that we get the information collected now fairly and put out in front of the public, in front of the city and county before they commit.
David Mann, I appreciate it. By the way, when's that suit's in? It's filed?
No, the suit won't be filed until the executive and the mayor signed the MOU. So today what we're understanding is both the county council and city council will give authority for the mayor and the executive to sign. Once they sign an MOU, that would trigger an appeal.
Any chance that the lawsuit won't be filed because they will in some way address your concerns?
I don't know. I'd have to see what they do.
All right, David Mann, I appreciate it.
Thank you.
David Mann is an attorney representing the International Longshore and Warehouse Union, Local 19, King County Council, Seattle Council, expected to approve the memorandum of understanding today, but the union says it will file a lawsuit to block a third sports arena in SoDo if there's not adequate environmental review. Weekday is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, Alexander Garrettin, our intern, Jack Walters is our engineer today. I'm Steve Scher. We'll talk to you again tomorrow.
KUOW 94.9 News and Information. The following is a required weekly test of the emergency alert system. This has been a required weekly test of the emergency alert system.
Support for KUOW comes from the Overlake School in Redmond, providing a rigorous college prep curriculum and a wide range of arts and athletics for grades 5 through 12. Open house for grades 5 and 6, October 16th from 9 to 11:30 a.m. Reservations required. Details at overlake.org.
94.9 KUOW.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.